Spotlight.com.
SpotlightOnPodcast.com/store is the place to go to get a Spotlight On collectible for the music and arts lover in your life, or maybe even yourself. Go to SpotlightOnPodcast.com/store today. Hello and welcome to Spotlight On, the podcast featuring musicians, writers, innovators, and ideas shaping media, entertainment, and culture. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. Today, the spotlight shines on Craig Maad, a writer, photographer, and walker who spent the last 20 years making Japan his home. Random House has just released Things Become Other Things, a walking memoir that traces his 300-mile journey along ancient pilgrimage paths in rural Japan. The book blends sharp prose with striking photography, capturing conversations with aging fishermen, inn owners, and cafe mamas while reflecting on friendship, loss, and the disappearing village life of Japan's key peninsula. This is an expanded and reimagined mass-market edition of the title Craig issued in a fine art edition directly to his online community of followers. His previous books include Kisa by Kisa, which explores Japan's old cafe culture, and Craig reaches some 40,000 readers through his newsletters on photography, literature, and walking. Craig's work sits at that perfect intersection of deep attention and wandering feet. And now, Craig Maad. I was listening to Rick Rubin interviewing Malcolm Gladwell the other day, and they had a little piece of their conversation that made me think of you and the discussion we were going to have. One of the things that Rick asked Gladwell was, do you ever have projects that or themes in your for your books that don't flesh out? Gladwell's answer was that he has so many outlets. It's rare that he can't use an idea. I think he may have even definitively said that never happens. It's basically he has so many different vehicles and outlets, from the podcast to essays to book chapters, etc. He can make his ideas work through one of his outlets.
Yeah,
that resonated for me to ask you something similar. You know, how, do you ever have to abandon a thread, or given your diversity of outlets, do you have a similar situation?
That's an interesting question. I, like Gladwell, I also have enough stuff that I've like kind of deliberately concocted on my own. Anyway, that's why the membership program exists. I mean, that was essentially a response to not having an outlet. I was deep in a year of working on an essay for The Atlantic, and then it got kind of like canned / I got ghosted. Like, it just didn't work out. And that's what catalyzed starting the membership program, and that's what catalyzed starting the Ridgeline newsletter, was that I didn't want to be in a position where I felt beholden to some random editor's whims on the other side of the world. Since then, I've been lucky in that I can usually find a place for something if I need to. But yeah, that was until 6 years ago. I definitely struggled with not finding homes for things or having to abandon certain things. I mean, probably for the best to a certain degree, because these things weren't necessarily the greatest versions of themselves. I've talked about this before, like from 2011 to 2016, 17. Yeah, 2011 to 2017, I spent working on a novel that was based off of burying my dad. And, you know, that didn't get published, which was probably good. And I got rejected for many, many things, but it allowed me to do all these residencies. So I got my Virginia Center for the Creative Arts residency, my Ragdale residency, Tin House. I got into Tin House through it. I was able to do the Iowa Writers Workshop kind of intensive. They have a 2-3 month intensive summer program where you can just do a bunch of workshops really quickly, like boot camp, like Iowa Writers Workshop boot camp. So that project got me into all those things. So even though it didn't have a classical piece of output in the sense of it didn't become a book that was published, it was a very useful tool for almost all of my 30s. In that sense, I was grateful for it. It was like a really good kind of training ground. And I met a bunch of interesting people and good friends still to this day through that project. So, you know, even the things that don't make it out into the world in the forms you expect them to make it out in, I think obviously have a lot of good, and this was one of them.
Yeah. You'd be very hard pressed to call that a failed endeavor.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You'd have to be a certain kind of person to view it through that lens. It's interesting that you tell that anecdote, though, because I've had instances in my own life where I've had younger people ask for advice about getting into creative fields. I've always said, just make your own work, you know, and that could be like, make a 30-second short, or you don't have to go make a feature film, but just have something that you can start and finish. And at the very least, you've practiced on your tools. Like, that's invaluable.
Yeah.
But you've also learned how to finish something. And that's pretty powerful as well as a creative.
Oh, it's everything. And that's what most people don't experience, because it's so easy to talk yourself out of finishing stuff. Kevin Kelly has a great quote. He says, don't be the best, be the only. And I love that. So, you know, that's another thing to keep in mind. Like, if you're working on stuff, or if you feel overwhelmed creatively, stop trying to be like the best illustrator, or the best like Miyazaki style illustrator or animator. Figure out what your weird, unique overlapping of skills and life experiences can make you the only of. And I think exactly like you say, you know, choose projects that you can complete. I mean, there's a reason they call it a practice, right? It's like literally that's all you're supposed to be doing, you know, essentially until you're dead. Just keep practicing. So yeah, I think that's really good advice.
I wonder if Kevin Kelly got that from Bill Graham. That's what he used to say about the Grateful Dead. They're not the best at what they do. They're the only.
Yeah, he probably did.
Yeah, it's a great line.
Although Kevin, I don't think, was a deadhead, but he was certainly in the scene peripherally at that point.
Yeah. It strikes me overall about many of your works, or a lot of your work, which is, I'm curious how the themes reveal themselves to you. So specifically with this work, this sort of intersection of walking and memory and friendship, the veracity of memory or the reliability of memory.
Yeah.
I think I want to pick at you about your process a little bit. You know, like, do these things emerge and you recognize them, or do you have this conscious intention that I want to craft a narrative that conveys this? Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, I would be hard pressed to say it was a conscious, you know, sort of deliberate thing. Yeah, I think a lot of it just comes from what I'm reading or who I'm inspired by or what books I feel moved by or drawn to, or there's something about the voice or something, you know. It's almost less about themes explicitly and more about just where the heart feels pulled towards. It sounds like very woo-woo-y, but I've just spent a lot of time reading all sorts of different books, and certain things speak to me more than other things. And so, like, Annie Dillard, in the way she writes about nature and writes about being in the world, is a huge influence, you know. And she, I don't think, has any kind of deliberate process. You know, when she was writing Tinker at Pilgrim Creek, she was just there. She was also really young. She was like 25 or something, 26 when she was writing that. And so I think I'm more drawn in that direction. And so standard narrative has always been really hard for me. Like, I'm uninterested in plot. I'm uninterested in explicit story. That's why a lot of what I do is vignette-y, because for me, it's not about, oh, like, are we hitting these plot points and does it take the reader to this place and that place? It's more about just the energy and the feel of almost each sentence, and then chapter by chapter, rather than necessarily the whole. I think Things Become Other Things is probably the most cohesive thing I've ever written, in the sense of there is this kind of story, there is this sort of reveal happening, there is this kind of like structure to it in terms of acts, you know. And the Fine Art edition has less of that than the Random House edition, so that was interesting working on those two editions and growing the Random House one through being able to work with my editor, who kind of helped guide it through basically just questions. You know, she got the Fine Art edition manuscript and then just sprinkled all over it, you know, hundreds and hundreds of questions all over the manuscript. And then basically the Random House edition is me responding to all of her questions and growing the narrative through that. And then us moving a few things around and trying to shape the narrative more intentionally. But it was a very organic, unexpected process. And I think the walks too, for me, and having all the logistics set up so I'm 100% focused on just the walking, and I don't have news or social media or podcasts or anything running in the background. And as I'm walking, that physical act, it just gets the mind moving and stuff just tumbles out, you know. And as I'm walking, I'm constantly dictating. And then that's how I'm able to do 2, 3, 4 1,000 words a night after walking for 8 hours.
Yeah.
And then out of that, you can start to find themes. I remember when I started working on Things Become Other Things about 4.5 years ago now, I went through all of the writing I did during the walk and printed it all out and then literally cut out of the text, cut out of the printouts, sentences and paragraphs that felt most resonant to me. And then I just put them all on the ground and shuffled them all up and then started just going through them again. And so that allowed me to kind of look at the themes that were naturally emerging during the walk in a way that was kind of divorced from the explicit linearity of the walk itself. So I was just trying to get like fresh eyes on like, what were we feeling? What things were kind of burbling up as we were walking? And that became the genesis for some of the first drafts. And then Brian started to sneak his way in more and more. And then an editor I was working on with for the Fine Art Edition, Ollie Chance, he really started helping me pull on that thread. And that's when that kind of expanded into more of a thematic part of the book. And then Molly Turpin, my editor at Random House, really helped flesh that out even further. I mean, Ollie and I kind of have a very minimalist aesthetic when it comes to literature, and we like things to be kind of sparse. And part of the reason I said yes to Random House was I wanted to kind of experience what a big publisher would do with a text like this. And it was super instructive. It was a really incredible experience to kind of go through that with Molly, who has an eye for a bigger audience, and having her pull on these threads, me respond to those pulls, those questions, being really proud of and excited about where we landed.
The story of it becoming a Random House edition is intriguing to me because it challenged an assumption I had, which was that larger, more mainstream presses don't like to pick up self-published titles. And quite honestly, I'm not even sure if that's true or if I invented that. But that was always my perception.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true, for sure. It's very rare. I mean, I think like Hugh Howey is a good example of someone who was militantly self-publishing. Hugh Howey wrote Silo, the books that became the Silo Apple TV show. They're called Wool, and he wrote a series of books. Basically, on his blog, I mean, he just had a publishing blog talking about Kindle and Kindle singles. This is like 15 years ago. And he sold hundreds of thousands of books, I think, independently on his blog. And then his stuff obviously then got picked up by big publishers. And then over a decade later, TV rights and movie, you know, TV shows are being made and all this stuff. So I think for him, he is a canonical example for me of someone who is able to do self-publishing, transitioning to much bigger platforms. Random House very much didn't want me to do my edition because I had those experiences with The Atlantic where, you know, I'd worked on something for so long and then it got ghosted and like I felt crushed. I'm now this kind of weird, you know, it's almost like a Great Depression survivor who's always kind of like hoarding wheat or something. I don't know what they did. People who
got a pantry full of cans of like tomato soup or something.
Yeah. So I've got so many beans. And so for me to give up, to me, what's most important is this independent platform. And I'm also just really proud of it. And the systems are all in place to produce great books. I've got my distributor, my printer. I've got like a whole marketing machine set up through my newsletters and membership program. You know, I've worked my whole life to kind of build this up. So this project that I tried to shop first and foremost to big publishers because I thought, okay, these themes deserve maybe a bigger platform than I can just give on my own. And honestly, it's about honoring Brian to a certain degree, our friendship, that memory. And then just like politically, I mean, you know, the timing of this book, I didn't obviously plan. I didn't know things were going to be so stupid at this point. But people who come from a town like mine understand the stupidity and have understood it almost cellularly for decades. So a lot of it isn't surprising, the stuff that's happening right now in the States. And to be able to have those conversations, I think, in a non-didactic way, I think that the book covers a lot of political themes. To do that in a non-didactic way, hyper-partisan way or whatever, is really important. It's one of the things I'm most proud of about the book. To do that on a bigger platform, to me, made sense. So I was shopping around, rejected by everyone. I couldn't get an agent. Everyone was saying, we can't sell this. And so I'd given up. I'd had one amazing meeting out of many, many meetings with Andy Ward at Random House. And we had this incredible meeting, super high energy, really just great. Andy is a mensch. He's just beloved by everyone who knows Andy. He's George Saunders' editor. So it's like, that says something. You know, George just feels like one of the greatest guys alive in contemporary publishing on so many levels. We had this amazing meeting and then he's like, oh yeah, we'll definitely get back to you. And then they didn't. I was like, I'm sent into kind of like the trauma place again, going back to the Atlantic and getting ghosted. And so then I just decided a couple months after that meeting, not hearing anything from them, I had to do this on my own. And that's when I got the machinery running. I was like, okay, let's prepare for this climb. It's going to be this big, crazy climb. Get all the gear ready, metaphorically prepare myself to do this book on my own. And it was 3 months into that process when they finally got back to me and were like, hey, yeah, we want this book. And so by that point, I was already committed to my own edition. That meant I was not going to compromise on that. So when I talked with Molly and she was like, yeah, we want this. I was like, do you really want it? Or people have said they wanted other things. I'm like, I'm doing this on my own. I have to do this on my own. I can't compromise on that. And she was like, okay, let me talk to everyone. We'll get back to you really quickly. And they did, to their credit. And they were very open to discussions, which was also great. I think because they just saw how unmoving I was going to be. And they offered quite a substantial advance to essentially buy me out of my edition, which just made me like them even more. Like, I was just like, okay, these people are serious and they get how important this is to me. But in the end, I said, look, we're not competing. $100 book is in no way competing with a $20 book. I'm going to give you guys a totally different edition. Like, I know this is weird and yada, 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 but I think it'd be great if we can do both of these and it would just make me feel so much better. And so we were able to hammer that out. I mean, the contract negotiation was a little bit annoying. And again, I was being triggered by all of this kind of scarcity mindset stuff and wanting to protect my own independence.
Yeah.
Because that is so critical. But in the end, yeah, we were able to get to a good place. And, now I'm basically not selling my edition because I so badly want everyone to read the Random House edition, because to me, that's the one you should read first. And then if you really, really, really are into that, like go find the Fine Art edition, which is a distillation of it. And it's a little bit of a different experience.
When you did the deal with Random House,
yeah,
everybody was aligned around the notion of, okay, it will be a, let's call it in air quotes, substantially different edition.
Yeah.
Did you have to commemorate that in terms of like in the contract, was there a word count that you had to commit to make it different? Like, how did you assure them it would be different? Or was this just you had learned each other so much at that point?
No, I mean, it was just faith. Yeah, the contract doesn't have anything about word count, but it does have clauses about pricing. So I'm limited to the number I can produce until I hit a certain number on the Random House side. And I can't price it below X. Like, there's some price, but I also don't want to price it below X. It's like, I'm very deliberate about like where things are priced right now. Yeah, those were the only constraints to give people a sense of, it wasn't just like, oh yeah, here's the contract. Perfect. Okay, great. We did go back and forth a lot about these numbers. Probably in the end, in a little bit of a, I don't know, I wouldn't say pointless way, because we landed in a place that was, not too different than where we started. But I wanted to push. There's just a few things I was trying to figure out. And I realized in the end, they were most concerned with hitting certain numbers. So like, big publishers just want to get, they want a book to do 10,000, right? Like, internally for me too, like, I really, really, really want us to sell 10,000 copies of this. Because that to me, the whole point of going with a big publisher is to get to those bigger numbers. Also, this price point, it's just a much easier possible thing to do than selling 10,000 $100 books is really hard. Although I'm pretty close to it now. We're in the sixth edition of Kisa by Kisa is being printed. We've sold over 6,000 copies of that. Things Become Other Things basically sold out of its 2,500 initial print run. And I've sold 1,000 Koya Bounds. And so we're close to 10,000 copies of 100.
Yeah, right.
It's crazy. Yeah. So it is possible, but it can take a while and over a few different books. But for this Random House one, they really want, and I really want us to get to 10,000. And I'm aiming for like 5,000 pre-orders. It's really hard. We are not, I don't think we're close to it yet. I mean, I'm kind of shocked. I get these little updates about, where we are with pre-orders, and I'm shocked by how hard it is to get someone to click a pre-order link. Gratification is delayed when the book doesn't come out for a month or 2 months or 6 months. And so I'm hoping that as we get closer to the pub date, and once we hit pub date, those calls to action will be a lot more heated. But the reason why you want to hit those pre-orders is because to get to the lists, and again, that's another when you're going with a big publisher, because I can't aspire to hit a New York Times bestseller list with an indie edition because they just aren't tracked. So that's another thing. It's like, well, if we're gonna go through this process, if we're gonna do this kind of contract or whatever, then let's also try to get on the list, because not for an ego reason, although it's like, sure, that's nice and that'll mean something to like my mom, she'll understand that, but like, again, it's about maximizing the reach of the story and maximizing the scale of the conversation we're able to have in order to have a bigger positive impact. You know, that's kind of what it is. And so you play all these stupid games, try to hit those sort of points, and then that gets you status points that you can cash in for other things and blah, blah, blah. So the contract, you know, was really, I realized when we were going back and forth a bunch and it was getting weird because I was like, why is it so hard for us to agree to this? I realized, oh, okay, they want these numbers. And so I was like, hey, look, let's just write those in. Let's just say I'm limited until I hit this number of sold copies on your end, and then I can produce infinite number on my end. And they were like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So it was about empathizing. Weirdly, I had to empathize with this giant corporation to get to the, you know, to get to a place we were both comfortable with. But it was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And if we don't hit those numbers anyway, I'm going to be sad. For me, I really want to hit those numbers. Not that like I'll consider the book a failure if we don't, but like, it feels like that's what we should be aiming for if we're doing a project like this. So
yeah, it's okay to have goals, right? It's like,
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to state them out loud.
And to use them as a forcing function to do a bunch of stuff like this, you know, like setting up all these podcasts and, and then the book tour, although a book tour doesn't sell books, but I'm doing the book tour because I think it's important to see people and to get out there. And like, when am I going to do something like this again?
Yeah.
Might as well.
Yeah. And you talked about empathizing with the big corporation, but it's also an acknowledgement of like, it's a statement of there's an alignment of objectives here that may be surprising to everyone.
Yeah.
You know, when you talked about sort of the formula of price point and quantity that would allow you to get back to your typical mode of operations, like that's a very reasonable arrangement. I was going to call it a concession, but it's not even that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah. Look, if we can't sell 10,000 copies of the Random House edition, then it's unlikely I'll need to make more of my edition anyway. And so that's fine. And maybe I don't make more of my edition. That's also fine. Having limited editions, I think, is also good. You know, Koya Bound is not going to be reprinted. There's just no reason to reprint it. You know, I'm producing this new photo book that I shot 90% of it in February, and it's going to print this week, basically. I just sent the InDesign files in last night. It's April 9th, we're recording this. That is meant to be now the fine art companion to the Random House edition. So it's funny, like you can keep playing with these things and you can build off them and you can use the constraints as further creative fuel. So this new photo book, I'm actually really, really excited about because first of all, I just think the photos are great. I also love that it's a photo only book, which is something I haven't done in about 10 years. It's actually my first solo photo only book because Koya Bound was with Dan Rubin. So this is just me, photos only, with a very short essay at the end. And I kind of love it. And it feels like a true perfect companion to the Random House edition, which to me feels like the canonical edition of the T-Bot story. And so that this kind of interplay to me feels really symbiotic and positive. And so anyway, it's none of this is planned. It's all this kind of improv jazz, feeling your way through things as you move forward. Like I have 5 books I want to do. I know the next 5. If you're like, okay, you can't do any more walking, you can't do any more traveling. Like if there's COVID again, I just had to sit home for like, say, the next 5 years. I know what I would do. I have all the books. I have all that stuff kind of drafted. Like I would just crank through these projects. Like I have enough kind of accrued, built up. Even though I have that, at the same time, I'm trying to be as flexible as possible and not be like, okay, these are the only things I can do. And also trying to build in these different these timeline scaled projects. So like this new photo book called Other Thing, we're going from shooting it to having it in people's hands in 2.5 months, which is pretty cool. Like that's pretty awesome. So I love that we're doing that. And that just makes me think like, why am I not doing at least one of these a year, you know, with other scale things happening in the background?
It's really interesting because, you know, our listeners can't experience this part of what I want to tell you, but just sitting here watching you speak about this process and what's going on with the photo book, the way you came alive talking about it, you can feel the enthusiasm that you have for the project. It's very palpable as your interlocutor. It's very interesting.
Yeah, well, I think it's what's exciting is it's surprising to me. Like this didn't exist 3 months ago, you know, none of it. It was just this impulse. It was like, yeah, I should probably go do this. And I didn't have time to do it. I had every excuse not to do it. The book is dedicated to my friend Enrique, who passed away in November last year, who was my roommate when I lived in California in 2010, 2011, 2012. He was just 38, so really young guy. And his memorial happened during when I was on the peninsula shooting this new book. I just brought my stepdaughter to boarding school in New Zealand like a couple weeks in January. I was exhausted from that. Like I don't like traveling. I don't like doing international travel. I really don't like airplanes. I don't like airports. It's just like vampiric to me. Like my life is just totally sucked out of me. Like everything about, if I look at my Aura Ring stats, like whenever I'm on planes or if I'm walking through airports, even though I try to be the Dalai Lama, I'm so stressed about everything and it's only gotten worse. I feel like I don't know. We're being ground to dust. I feel like when you engage with these worlds. So I don't want to be traveling. And I just finished the New Zealand stuff and then they announced his memorial and I had already planned the other thing photo walk. And I'd been in contact with all these inns and I had all this stuff set up. And the thought of flying, also flights are just so expensive now. And the thought of flying to California for basically a weekend or whatever, because that was about all I would be able to fit in. I was like, I can't do this. And I felt so bad about it because I really wanted to be there with everyone celebrating Enrique's life. And so what I tried to do was when I was shooting the photo book, I just tried to like keep Enrique in mind and embody his positivity and his joy and love of life and connection. And so I tried to really think about that while I was shooting all these people. And I felt really bad to miss the memorial. So the photo book is dedicated to him. That feels about right. I think Enrique would be psyched that I was doing that. And he'd be like, dude, I'm dead. Like, you don't need to come to my memorial. So anyway, just the fact that this project has like all these different facets to it, whereas 3 months ago it didn't exist. It's exciting. You know, there's always something like this right there to be done. And it's almost like a theological, you have to build up this belief system that you can go out there, you can do it, you can find it, you can shoot it. If you go put in the energy, you're going to find something interesting. Going to the peninsula, doing this project 2 months ago was a huge act of faith. I didn't know who I was going to see or meet, if we were going to get any good photos. I was shooting mainly with film too for the first time on a big project like this. That was terrifying, not knowing, are the cameras even working properly? You know, it's like, are the shutters firing off in the right way? You can't check anything in the moment. And so just having this tremendous amount of faith going into it, and then also keeping Enrique in mind and all that stuff. So it was pretty powerful. And then to come out of that, have a bunch of work I'm proud of, forming these new relationships with like kind of photo studios and the scanner around the corner for me and all that stuff. It's exciting. And again, that was just there waiting to be done. I could have done that. I could have done this at any moment in the last year. And I don't know. I think for young artists, creators, it can be so hard to have that kind of faith, to commit to a project and believe that something interesting is going to come out of it. The reality is like, for the most part, interesting things aren't going to come out of your projects. Like they're going to be, there's that Ira Glass quote about taste and skill, taste and talent, where like your taste, like when you're young, always outstrips your talent. And like you spend a lot of your time as a young artist trying to pull up your talent to match your taste, but it can be so discouraging early on. A lot of people just get frozen and stop there. So I empathize. When I think about my 20s and the work I did in my 20s, it was a huge constant struggle of not being able to hit taste points that I wanted to hit. But you just got to put in the practice.
We'll be back with more Spotlight On and Craig Maad right after this break.
After listening to this episode, head to thetonearm.com, our new online journal covering unexpected music and culture. This week on The Tone Arm, part one of our conversation with digital artist Tomiko Thiel, where she reveals the origin of the connection machine. Chicago's Sons of Ra detail their mix of jazz, metal, and the influence of Coltrane's social commentary in the song Alabama. Clarinetist Sam Sedagursky channels memories from the ruins of the Borscht Belt for his work, The Solomon Diaries. And Sam Besty of the Vernon Spring discusses the mysterious process of sculpting silence. You'll find all this and more on The Tonearm. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to our email newsletter. That's thetonearm.com. The Tonearm, putting a needle on the cultural wax.
And now, back to Spotlight On. When working on the Random House edition, was the editing process different than your typical works and your fine art editions? And by that, I don't just mean because you were working with Molly as a personality and as a different human, but it seems to me like this process was more about adding as opposed to going for that minimalist aesthetic you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how the process may or may not have been different, may or may not have been more or less enjoyable? Like, I'm curious about your experience of that.
Yeah, I mean, it was great because I had done the fine art edition. Like, I think there was like my shoulders were able to drop. I was able to be less stressed. I'd gotten a bunch of feedback from readers, positive feedback from readers about the fine art edition. I didn't have this kind of, oh my God, can we do this? What's this going to be? Worry that you can have when you're working on an early manuscript. So I was in this sort of like, all right, screw it. Let's just push this thing. Like YOLO. Like there's no downside to pushing this thing. Let's just see how far we can push it. And again, this idea of contracts and getting paid for things gives you a kind of permission to do these different things. So I was like, okay, I'm putting on like this different writerly hat now because I have this contract with Random House, because they're paying me this advance, which I, you know, even though they let me do my edition, or even though we came to an agreement where I was going to do my edition, I still got a really decent advance for a first, quote unquote, first time author doing a weird esoteric memoir. You know, I mean, I like totally like honorable and good advance, you know? So anyway, because of that, I was like, okay, this is my job to like lean into this and like, all right, let's push it. Let's see where we can go. And so what we did was we took the fine art edition manuscript and I just shoved that in a Google Doc. We did all of our back and forth in a Google Doc, actually. It was great. We weren't using Word at all until much later in the process, which people who've worked with big publishers were just shocked that we were using Google Docs to go back and forth. But it really is. It's the best commenting, collaborative kind of editing space, thinking space, I think. Molly just left a trillion questions all over this Google Doc, and I was able to go through and we were able to have little conversations in the margins of clarifying the questions. And then I was able to use that. And then I had my own doc. I wasn't writing in the Google Doc because I think it's a little too exposing to like have that kind of real time, because she'd get notifications, Craig modified the file or whatever. Like, I didn't want that. So I kind of went into a writing hole for about 6 months with all of her questions and just started fleshing it out. Building and building and building. And I just realized really quickly, like, I had so much more to say. You know, also in writing, the fine art edition was such a convoluted process because it was like I had this pop-up walk I did and I wrote a bunch in there and it was just like daily bloviations, dumping text into, you know, the newsletter. And then I cut up all the printouts and I had all the paragraphs and sentences. And then I kind of rewrote around that. And then Brian started to like really become more and more of this kind of forefront character. And then it was like, okay, I've got to like cut all this, all these other people out of it and rewrite around Brian. So the fine art edition was really convoluted in a lot of ways to get to that final product. It wasn't this like straight line at all. And so because of that, being able to return to the manuscript where the manuscript had kind of a clear thrust and start again in a way, and think about all the stuff that had been cut. So the characters that have been taken, like John doesn't exist in the fine art edition at all. I remember I was like really sad when I had to tell John, I'm like, sorry, I'm cutting you out of the book entirely. He was like, John doesn't care. To be able to bring him back intentionally and also to reframe the book, the way the Random House edition opens, it opens with a chapter I don't get to in the fine art edition until 3/4 of the way through. I think to get to that chapter two took me all, you know, writing all the way to that point and then being like, that chapter to me felt like a pivot for the fine art edition. Anne Lamott, like Bird by Bird, all the, you know, you read all these books about writing, on writing, Stephen King. It's like, if you have something great, play that card immediately. And there was a certain energy I was getting from that shift in the book three quarters of the way through the fine art edition. And I was like, this is how the book should just start. This whole book is just a letter to Brian. Like that's kind of what happens. It's like I'm tiptoeing in the fine art edition, then three quarters of the way through, it like shifts to this letter to Brian. And then the last quarter is kind of like facing him. And I was like, the whole book should be facing him. Like, screw this. Like, you know, that energy I want to imbue with the whole book. And then once we did that, which was like this major surgery, it gave the book space to be so many other things. And bringing John back in was a big part of it. And then bringing John back in allowed us to bring in the Book of John and all of this historical background and more context about me and say all this stuff, because now Brian wasn't this thing we were building up to. Brian was acknowledged from page one, and he was able to be present through it all. And that was exciting to have that. So yeah, I mean, talking through this, it sounds insane, but, and I don't think most books are this convoluted, but this book had to be to get to where we got it to.
It's interesting because it doesn't sound convoluted to me. Actually, it sounds like a very unique and special experience to be able to go back and take a work, revisit it, rework it, re-engineer it, expand it, rediscover it.
Yeah.
And even the process you articulated about getting Molly's questions and then going away, like that seems rather orderly. And I'm sure there's more nuance than what you described, but it doesn't sound like it was a shit show by any means.
No, it wasn't a shit show, but it was just like, it was so improv jazz. You know, I mean, it was just, nothing was planned. It was just tap dancing here and there and like avoiding these pitfalls and these traps, trying to avoid those traps or whatever. Yeah. And I think you can over revisit something too, you know? And so that was always like top of mind. Like I would say there's 0.0000001% chance. I won't say there's no chance, but there's almost no chance I would ever want to come back to this and do something with it again. Like I am so sick of this manuscript and so sick of this story. I think that's actually how you want to feel when you launch a book. Like that means you've just wrung and wrested from it every drop you could possibly get from it. And I just recorded the audiobook on Sunday morning and Monday morning. Oh, 15 hours I was in the studio recording an audiobook, which is basically like waterboarding your brain. I mean, it's terrible. So much respect for professional audiobook people, because like that, it's hard. Maybe if you do it a lot, I mean, I'm sure if you do it a lot, it gets easier, but holy crap, man, that process just took everything out of me. Monday after the studio, I was like, oh, I'm going to do all this work. You know, I had to get this InDesign file done. I was a shell. And also reading the second half of the book, and you're not just reading it, you're performing it in a way and kind of accessing all the emotion of the second half of the book where like, I mean, it was actually really exciting to reread it. We found one copy error, which is really annoying because we really combed the hell out of this thing. So there's one word that's in there that shouldn't be in there. And there's one bar over an O that's missing on one of the Japanese romanizations. But this, that was interesting to see that. We were like, you know, because it's like you're reading so psychotically closely of this text when you're doing the audiobook because it has to be perfect. Has to be identical. And you know, and the producer kept stopping me. He was in California and he kept stopping me and being like, oh, you said a when it's the, and it's like redo these sentences. But reading the book and feeling the energy of the second half of it and the emotion of the second half of it in this almost out of body way was really exciting. Like that was really sweet. I was like, wow, yeah, the second half really does have this kind of heightened energy. I think it just accesses this. The first half is closed off, essentially protecting myself. And then the second half is when, you know, the guard is kind of let down. And I felt that in the reading and the energy I got from the reading, even though I was exhausted and used up, there was this kind of high from it too. Anyway, I hope the audiobook is okay. Like, cause it,
well, it's funny you terrifying. Talk about it because that was also in the Gladwell interview the other day. He was talking about how awful it was having to do his audiobook and that he actually realized he couldn't read some of his own prose and he went back and rewrote it so it was actually readable because he said the way he wrote, it was just never meant to be spoken out loud and he couldn't get through it.
Yeah.
And so he just rewrote the paragraph and read it for the audiobook in a way that was actually readable.
Oh, I rewrote. I wanted to rewrite a bunch of stuff for the audiobook and I kind of held back. And there was one sentence where I was like, we're rewriting this. I can't say this because I used the word particular three times.
Ugh.
You start looking at these words and you start to lose your mind because it's just, you just start to go loopy. And I had to say on this a particular shrine, on this particular peninsula, on this particular day. And I was like, oh, no, no, sorry, sorry, sorry. Particular is the word I switched it to. I was like, wow, why is this so easy to say now? It was peculiar.
Oh, yeah.
Try saying that three times.
That's awful. Yeah.
This peculiar shrine on this peculiar peninsula. On this I was like, I can't do it. So we changed it to particular, which is more fun. So particular. You could say that.
Yeah, it's easier to say.
Peculiar. Say that three times and then match it with peculiar peninsula. No, it's like you just can't do it. So I forced us to rewrite. I was like, I'm the author. Come on, we're getting rid of this sentence.
It actually seems like the audiobook should be the last thing that gets done before the book goes to press so that you could you could capture any final.
100%. I think normally it would be done that way. But for some reason, we've been working on a little bit of a crunch schedule. I think because I was slow in getting a bunch of my rewrites to them in the fall. I was about a month behind. And so that pushed everything. And then we hit the end of the year crunch. And then I had the Kisa by Kisa Japanese edition come out. And that took up a bunch of my time. And I couldn't do more. I couldn't do another pass on the revisions. So I think normally, yes, I think that probably happens. But right now we're kind of like everything's last minute. But thankfully, just one word. You know, that's fine.
I appreciate that our time together is coming towards its end, and there's a bunch of stuff that I know we're not going to get to, but I do want to ask you a couple more questions if we can get them in.
Sure.
I'm really curious about your relationship or your thinking about analog and digital.
Yeah.
Walking, bookmaking, analog.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your relationship with digital tools and digital environments. You know, you talk about it a lot. You talk about sort of your media diet, if you will, or your media starvation in some cases. But I'm curious also, I think about a lot of this as like experiments with disconnection.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about, you know, your relationship or your philosophy of technology use? Like when you were talking earlier, something I was curious about was your daily writing practice and the dictation. Like, do you use speech to text software or do you transcribe? And has that changed over the years? And I'm less interested in that specifically, although I'm interested in that, and more about your overall sort of philosophy of tech.
Yeah. I mean, for the walking and talking stuff, it's all speech to text, just in notes using Siri, basically. There's probably better options now. I mean, all the OpenAI stuff, all the LLM stuff, this is so much better at transcription. Like the series,
the thousands of dollars I've spent in my life on transcription that I pay now $19.99 a month for.
Oh, it's insane. Yeah. Well, but I mean, like, come on, that talk about thankless jobs we're getting rid of. Like transcription is like, you can't, like, that's almost worse than recording an audiobook. At least recording an audiobook, like you're producing something useful. Transcriptions are like you're producing an artifact that is in and of itself a thing, whereas transcriptions are often just like whatever, secondary stuff or supplementary stuff or whatever. So yeah, no, but like just the way you can speak bilingually to an LLM too is really powerful. So I can say, hey, I'm walking the Kii Peninsula in Japan.
Yeah.
I'm going to be mentioning a bunch of places that are down here. I'm going to be speaking English, but I'm going to be mentioning these places, these Japanese places, please transcribe those accurately or whatever. And then they will. And I won't have to, right now I have to like spell things out. Like I'll be like KIIKATSUUUR. And it's like hard to do these romanizations and like do them in real time. So my files are full of all these and it does them in all caps. So it's like, it's just kind of weird. But yeah, basically just Siri in notes and just this running notes file of Siri transcriptions. But otherwise, like my core philosophy, and I'm someone who grew up, I'm that elder millennial generation where we had a taste of pure analogness in childhood and then quickly shifted to digital early teens, but not smartphone psycho digital that we have, dopamine crazy digital that we have today. So I've experienced kind of all three, I would say, like categories of from the whole spectrum from analog to extreme plugged inness. For me, I've landed on the digital stuff isn't real. Like nothing happening on the internet should be considered permanent or should be considered in and of itself a final artifact. And that's why with my members stuff, I always say, first and foremost, whenever I run a board meeting, the purpose of this program is two things. We're making books, physical books. That's the number one purpose of this program. And the number two is education. That's why I run like the board meetings and stuff like that. But the education stuff directly comes out of doing things that make me better at making the physical books. So it's not this like totally altruistic thing of, oh, I'm just going to like do educational stuff because I feel like I should. I'm doing it because it helps me do the other stuff better. So everyone, it's like a win-win, you know, everyone really wins. But the reason why I've landed on the only thing that matters is the books is because that really does feel like the place to have the best conversation. And by focusing on the books, and to have the best conversation in the sense of, I want people to engage with this stuff with their full attention. And I want to be having conversations with folks that are totally present. And I think a physical book is still maybe the best way to do that, even more than a movie, because, you know, you turn a movie on, people are still reaching for their phones. You can have the ambience of a movie and you're still doing all this other stuff with your attention. Whereas a book, like if you're not fully in it, you're not in it. You can't multitask with a book. And so I think it is a perfect focused piece of technology, piece of media. And in that way, it's really exciting. All of this other stuff is supplementary in my mind. And all of this other stuff will be gone. It will disappear. The archives, you know, the digital stuff is so tenuous. But if you put 1,000 printed books out in the world, unless someone really hates you and hunts down, makes it a point to hunt down every copy and burn every copy, chances are that artifact is going to be in the world forever, you know, for hundreds of years. And I don't think there's any other piece of media that you can say that about. So if end-to-end books force you to collimate your thinking because they are so final, there isn't a way to go back to them and revise them in the form that they're in. Yeah, you can do the things like I've done with the Random House edition and kind of new editions and stuff like that. But that's it for that form of the thing. And so because of that, it creates this sense of deadline and a sense of refinement that online stuff, digital stuff doesn't bring to the table. It doesn't bring that sense of urgency. And so that also makes it exciting for me in the sense of like, this is the best version of this thing I could have possibly done. And here it is, immutable. Here it is in the world, in thousands of copies, hopefully tens of thousands or whatever for this Random House edition. And it's probably going to be here forever. And like that feels like it's respecting the project in a way that a lot of digital only stuff doesn't respect the project, certain things. Like when I think about YouTube a lot and I think about the people on YouTube, I think about how much effort is going into these channels and how much time and production now today is being put into these things. And it kind of breaks my heart that there is no real archive of this stuff. There's no, even with DVDs and Blu-rays, at least you had like some physical media, even though it's like not very robust physical media. With prints, 35 millimeter prints, at least if those are archived properly, they can kind of last a long time. But a lot of this YouTube stuff is just all of this creative energy kind of going to this place where it sort of evaporates.
Even worse with TikTok, anything you create in app.
Oh yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah. 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 So exactly. So there's, I think the only way to think about those mediums is to assume they're temporary. But, you know, I'm friends with like Derek Mueller from Veritasium, you know, and Derek has created essentially this incredible TV show entirely on YouTube. And I do wonder, is there a way we could archive this? And is there a Veritasium book that he should do that's somehow distills a lot of these great videos and a lot of the amazing infographics he's produced into some kind of printed archive? Because that feels like it would honor the work he's done in a way that just existing on YouTube doesn't.
Yeah.
The scale is different, obviously. And you have to think about that and you have to keep that in mind. You know, Derek's reaching hundreds of millions of people on YouTube, but what is the quality of that attention? What is the quality of that conversation? I think, you know, those are important questions to ask. So for me, you know, the original question was like, how do I think about digital and physical, digital and analog? More and more, I think the power of analog is becoming readily apparent as digital becomes more and more diffuse. It's obvious that we aren't going to be able to archive everything because there's so much stuff is being produced. For me, I'm really grateful to have this analog practice, which I've been doing my whole life or my whole adult career with physical books. And so for me, it's really intuitive. And I do think physical books are kind of a perfect analog instantiation. I think they are a perfect piece of technology to a certain degree. And we've we kind of have really dialed it in and perfected it. And we're really lucky that we have the postal system. Global postal systems are pretty incredible. Robin Sloan just produced this print-only zine that I have here. They did with his Rhizograph. It just says, reality has a surprising amount of detail on one side. And it's this beautiful kind of, I guess this is, what size is this? This is probably A3, I think, folded over twice. It's got this photo of this pilot on it. And then on the back, he has this essay that only exists in this printed zine. And he just, it's this basically love letter to the U.S. postal system, an acknowledgement of the miraculousness of it, the miracle that is global U.S. postal systems, because he's like, I can mail this thing anywhere in the world for basically for $1.65. That's insane. And it's insane to me that for all of the fractured nature of politics today, that the world has agreed on postal system as functioning everywhere that basically isn't a war zone. Because you think about it, it's weird. It's like you pay $1.65 in the US, but you can send it anywhere in the world. Doesn't that create kind of a postal deficit? So the thinking was that, you know, say, okay, Robin mails me this in Japan. Japan's not getting any money from that stamp. You know, it's like it's arriving in Japan. Then Japan is, the Japanese postal system is agreeing to this global agreement where we say, okay, we are going to, but they keep track of the trade imbalance. But the thinking was that a letter begets a letter. So this letter coming here, I would respond in kind to the person back in the States. So I'm going to pay the Japanese postal rate to send it back to America. So you'd cancel those things out. Obviously, that doesn't happen all the time. And there is a rectification of postal imbalances you can look it up on Wikipedia. It's pretty interesting. So at the end of like whatever, a year, I don't know what the time frame is, but Japan goes, hey, America, we've covered X hundreds of millions of dollars in postage for you. I don't even know if it ever gets that big. And then America goes, okay, yeah, you know, okay, we'll pay that out. Or, you know, Italy, hey, you owe us $20,000 in postage. It kind of gets balanced out. But it is miraculous that this all works. And Robin's kind of acknowledging that. For me too, my practice couldn't exist. My books, my independent book system couldn't exist without this system. And the fact that, and you know, I charge what I'm charged for shipping and handling, which is about like $30, right? So $30, I can send this object beautifully packaged, protected, and it arrives pretty much anywhere in the world in 2 or 3 days. It's essentially a teleportation device. And for $30, I can teleport this, you know, this object that weighs almost a kilo, kind of big and onerous, and it arrives in perfect mint condition anywhere in the world. Is like acknowledging the fact that we can do that and that the cost is reasonable, I think is really important. Anyway, so that's a very long-winded response. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot poetic around that, because what it is you're teleporting as well is a piece of your soul, a piece of your intellect, like your lived experience. So yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
It's very cool.
All right. Before I let you go, a quick one and then another one.
Sure.
Will there be an ebook edition of The Random House?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there will be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have to concede to that, or were you okay with that?
No, I don't care. I have no preciousness with this Random House edition. Also, it's just printed in essentially mass market hardcover form, so it's on that kind of rough, I mean, I really love that sort of rough mass market paper that, you know, it's just salt of the earth paper. It's a book, it says book, and it's all black and white and everything's kind of grainy, so there's no preciousness to it. So yeah, I'll like make every edition, like they can do what there's no preciousness to it. So yes, there will be an edition. I'm very happy to have it.
That's wonderful out there. So you're about to, you know, the book's going to press. We've got the early May street date. The things are going to happen that are going to happen. I noticed it's number one in travel, in Japanese travel guides on Amazon today. So congratulations.
Whatever. Thanks. Exactly. Whatever that means. There's probably like six. That means I sold six books.
Well, you know, I come from the music business where a number one record in America sells 80,000 units. And it's like, we're a nation of 360 million people and 80,000 units is a number one record. Like, go team.
Well, for books, it's even smaller. I mean, like 5,000.
Yeah.
5 to 10,000 puts you on the bestseller lists.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's really incredible.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you're doing the podcast, you're going to go on the book tour. That ends. You go back to Japan, you sit down, you exhale, then what?
I have no idea. I just know I'm going to need recovery time. That's...
Yet you have 5 years of projects staring down the barrel at you.
Yeah. Well, so I'm setting up, a new studio, and that's directly in service to those next projects. And so that's sort of my goal for July, August, is to do, I hope, as little travel as possible. I hope really get this new studio space dialed in a way that it's all, you know, look, I could do these projects in a closet if I needed to. Like, I don't need a perfect workspace to get these things done. I think that's really important to acknowledge, but it would be amazing. This would be the first time in my life I have a true, fully dedicated project space, because I'm always like taking over my living room or whatever, and like the floor is covered in the book for weeks, and I'm hopping around them and there's dust and hair and crap on everything. It just sucks. So to have a true, again, not like massive, but like big enough workspace where I'll be able to map these things out in a way that feels exciting, feels fun. And it feels like that'll be a totally different register of brain to be using. And so I'm excited to hopefully just be able to come back and lean into that and build that space out. Just take stock of things. You know, it's like going on Tim Ferriss a couple weeks ago, like that pod came out and I've got hundreds of emails that I, you know, there's no way I'm going to be able to respond to all the stuff that came in from that. But I would like to spend a little time sitting with it. And when I'm on this tour, I'm not going to be able to do anything but the tour. And so I expect there's going to be a backlog of stuff. Like, I'm just going to, and I'd like to just have quiet time where I'm not working on a book. I'm not doing interviews. I'm just getting the studio space built out in a way that feels great and kind of reflecting on these first, you know, basically March, April, May, June of this year. So we'll see.
Thank you so much, Craig Maude. And as always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On. Spotlight On is executive produced and hosted by me, Lawrence Puryear. We're produced and marketed by Michael Donaldson. Editing and sound design is by Terry Grant. Our theme music is by Q Burns Abstract Message. The most important member of our team is you. Thank you for supporting our work. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts, and then visit us online at spotlightonpodcast.com. While you're there, explore the free episode archive. Thanks for listening. Be safe and stay in touch.